Getting out of orbit with only Aquarius's engines would have been a much iffier proposition. If it had happened when the LM was on the surface, there would have been no recovery. He and Hayes would be doomed men, and Jack Swigert would be dead, circling the moon in a command module without power, or an engine, or oxygen. Lovell realized it couldn't have happened at a better time. Unlike Neil Armstrong and Pete Conrad, Jim Lovell had not received any pre-flight promise from Tom Paine about letting him and his crew fly the next mission if they had to abort. Another team of astronauts would have that chance. But when would that be? At the very least, Lovell suspected, there would be a hiatus of months while NASA tried to figure out what went wrong. At worst, if they didn't make it back, it could mean the end of the Apollo program. Yesterday, during an idle moment, Lovell had said to Jack Swigert, "I'm afraid this is going to be the last lunar mission for a long time." What he didn't know then was that the comment was heard live, on hot mic. Tom Paine, waiting out the ordeal, went before the press to explain that, yes, there would be an investigation into Apollo 13, but after that, most definitely, NASA was going back to the moon. By Thursday afternoon, the cold had begun to invade Aquarius. The command module, again, was even colder. At one point, Lovell went up to Odyssey to get some hot dogs out of the pantry, and they were practically frozen. The men had donned a second set of cotton long johns, and they discussed the idea of putting on their spacesuits to stay warm, but had decided against it. They wouldn't be able to turn on the suit fans because they ate up too much power. Without any ventilation, they'd overheat and perspire, then run the risk of getting seriously chilled if they had to take them off. But their long johns provided little warmth, and the Teflon-coated fabric of their coveralls was cold to the touch. Jack Swigert, meanwhile, had his own troubles. Almost a day earlier, he'd been in his usual place, straddling the ascent engine cover, when he realized his feet were immersed in a puddle of water. The LM's drinking water dispenser had been leaking. Swigert's feet were soaked, and soon, after several trips back and forth to the command module, half frozen. He'd been rubbing them ever since to get them dry. This morning, Lovell and Hayes had broken out their lunar boots to help keep their own feet warm, and Hayes had offered his pair to Swigert, but he declined. He wanted to keep rubbing his feet. The afternoon dragged on with the three men shoulder to shoulder in Aquarius, trying to stay warm. Mission Control had promised to read up the lengthy checklist for tomorrow's re-entry, but it wasn't ready yet. The cold only made the waiting seem longer. Around 6 p.m., with no checklist yet in sight, the conversation in Aquarius turned to Ken Mattingly. If he were sick, he ought to be breaking out with red spots by now. Before the flight, Lovell had worked out a code with the Capcoms so he could find out Mattingly's condition covertly. Now he asked Vance Brand, "Are the flowers in bloom in Houston?" "No, not yet," Brand replied. "Still must be winter." "Suspicions confirmed," Lovell said. "I doubt if they will be blooming even Saturday when you return," Brand ventured. Not only was Mattingly healthy, but he'd been working like mad with Gene Kranz's controllers to put together the re-entry checklist. At 6:30, Vance Brand radioed that it was nearly ready and that Swigert should get ready to copy it down. "He'll need a lot of paper," Brand said. By 7:19, Swigert was still waiting, and Lovell could no longer hide his irritation. "They couldn't just wait around up here," he told Brand. "They had to have the procedures in time to study them. And then we've got to get the people to sleep." Finally, around 7:30 p.m., Mattingly entered Mission Control, checklist in hand, and sat down at the Capcom's console to talk to the man whose fate had been so strangely entwined with his own. No words of greeting passed between them, no ironic remarks. It was all business. "Hello, Aquarius. Houston, how do you read?" "Okay, very good, Ken. Okay, let me take it from the top here." There followed a conversation that lasted the better part of 2 hours as Mattingly read every switch setting, every keystroke of the computer, the steps that would bring Odyssey back to life and ready for re-entry. After every line, Swigert repeated what he had heard. Around 9:15, it was time to copy the LM checklist. Mattingly assured Swaggart that both checklists had been tested together in the simulators, and he added, "We think we've got all the little surprises ironed out for you." "I hope so," Swaggart said, "because tomorrow is examination time." Friday, April 17th, 1:41 a.m. Houston time, 5 days, 12 hours, 28 minutes mission elapsed time. "Fred, are you sleeping?" "Go ahead." Mission Control had planned to let the crew of Apollo 13 sleep through the night, but early Friday morning Hayes was awakened by Jack Lozma, who had a minor change in the checklist for him to copy. Soon it was clear that Jack Swaggart was also awake. For the benefit of the doctors, who were keeping tabs on the astronauts' rest periods, Lozma asked, "How much sleep did you get, Jack?" "I guess maybe 2 or 3 hours." "You plan to get any more?" "Well, if I get everything done, I'll try, but I tell you, it's almost impossible to sleep. All of us have that same problem. It's just too cold." By now, Aquarius II was like a damp cave. The temperature hovered in the mid-40s. The LM's environmental control system, designed for warmer temperatures and only two men, was overloaded with moisture, not only from the exhalations of the three men, but in the wet, frigid air that drifted in from Odyssey. Big globs of water, shimmering in zero-G, clung to every bend in the exposed plumbing and the wire harnesses. The windows were clouded with moisture. The men had to wipe off the instrument panel to read a gauge. The stack had strayed so far from its normal orientation, the thermal control spin had deteriorated badly, that the sun no longer appeared in Aquarius's windows. It was shining down on the service module's engine bell. The men waited out these last hours in near darkness, studying the checklist by flashlight, rubbing their hands together. Years later, Ken Mattingly would look back on the performance of Lovell and his crew with amazement. For more than 3 days, they had been living only for survival, in miserable conditions, with nothing exciting to break up the long hours of waiting. And yet, they never lost their temper with each other or with Mission Control. And if Jim Lovell got on the radio every once in a while and let his frustration hang out a little, he was still the epitome of restraint. If Apollo 13 had to happen to any spacecraft commander, Mattingly would say later, there wasn't anyone could have handled it better than Jim Lovell. 2:06 a.m. "Hey, Jim, while you're up and things are nice and quiet, let me give you a couple of things to think about." Deke Slayton sounded almost as tired as the man he was talking to. "I know none of you are sleeping worth a damn because it's so cold, and you might want to dig out the medical kit and pull out a couple of dexedrines apiece." "We might consider it," Lovell answered. Privately, he worried that the letdown from the drug would leave them more tired than they already were. "Wish we could figure out a way to get a hot cup of coffee up to you," Slayton said. "It'd probably taste pretty good about now, wouldn't it?" "Yeah, it sure would. You don't realize how cold this thing becomes." Hearing this, Jack Lozma offered his own words of encouragement. "Hang in there. It won't be long now." 2:35 a.m. "Okay, Skipper, we figured out a way for you to keep warm." It was Jack Lozma's voice. "We decided to start powering you up now." "Sounds good," Lovell said. "And you're sure we have plenty of electrical power to do this?" "That's affirmative. In fact, Aquarius had come through so well that from here on in, there would be twice as much power and water as the men would need." Lozma's go-ahead came none too soon. As he set to work turning on the systems, Hayes looked at his window and thought he could almost see frost. By 3:15, Lovell and Hayes had brought Aquarius fully to life, and Lovell told Lozma it was warming up a little. Lozma answered, "Duck blinds are always warmer, Jim, when the birds are flying." 4:59 a.m. Apollo 13 was only 55,000 miles away from Earth, heading toward it at 6,100 miles per hour. When Lovell steered the stack into position for a new mid-course burn, the planet was a crescent of impressive size and growing larger by the minute. But even now, Lovell's crew could not rest easy. Something was still causing their angle of attack to shallow slightly. Throughout the past couple of days, the men had seen more spurts of gas from the service module. Suddenly the constellations would be lost in a flurry of sparkles, but Houston assured them that couldn't be the cause. Whatever the force bending Apollo 13's trajectory, it had to be corrected. All that was needed was a gentle 21-second nudge from Aquarius's maneuvering thrusters. But Lovell was so tired that he called up the computer program for the descent engine instead. In Houston, sharp-eyed controllers caught the mistake in plenty of time. Tiredness was not the only cause of Lovell's mistake. Ever since Houston had told him that water was tight, confirming Hayes's numbers, Lovell had decided to ration drinking water. The men had made good use of the water left in the command module's drinking tank, but Lovell had been particularly stringent about his own water consumption. The situation was compounded by the fact that in zero-G, astronauts generally don't feel thirsty as often as they do on the ground. Though he did not realize it, he was becoming dehydrated. He would later find out that the loss of electrolytes made him more prone to errors. Fred Hayes had his own problem. He was sick, and all because of a misunderstanding with mission control. After the accident, with Odyssey powered down, the men couldn't use the normal system of dumping urine overboard. It required electricity to heat the line and keep it from freezing. Instead, they'd used an alternate line which dumped urine through a fitting in the command module's side hatch. But mission control told them that the resulting swarm of ice droplets around the spacecraft was ruining their Doppler tracking data. Please don't dump any more urine. They neglected to say, for the time being. Lovell and his crew interpreted the request as a permanent ban. The misunderstanding created an immediate problem of where to store urine, and for nearly 3 days they'd been using every suitable bag and container, stashing them in the LM storage cabinets. But it also led, indirectly, to Hayes's illness. Mission Control's request came at a time when the men were very busy. The easiest way to store urine, they decided, was to use the collection bags they normally wore inside their spacesuits. They kept them on while they worked, for some number of hours, until the pace of events slackened. That saved some time. But it also meant they were bathing themselves in urine, and that made them vulnerable to infection. By Thursday evening, Hayes had developed a urinary tract infection, although he did not know it. He knew only that he was experiencing a burning pain when he urinated, and on Friday morning, when Hayes went up to Odyssey to go to the bathroom, he bumped up against the walls with his bare skin. The cold metal drained the warmth out of him. When he returned to Aquarius, he was shivering badly. He zipped himself into a sleeping bag and floated before the instrument panel. Swigert felt his head. He didn't seem to have a fever. The shivering stopped after a couple of hours, but for the first time in the flight, Hayes felt truly exhausted. 7:15 a.m. After the mid-course burn, it was time to cast off the stricken service module. Jack Swigert had been in Odyssey for more than 2 hours, where he had begun to turn on some of the systems drawing power from Aquarius, another bit of ingenuity from Houston. To guard against a lethal mistake, Swigert had put tape over the switch marked LM Jettison. Down in Aquarius, Lovell pulsed the thrusters to impart momentum and yelled, "Fire!" Swigert hit the switch marked SM SEP, and there was a bang of pyrotechnic bolts, and the service module was away. Lovell immediately swung the joined LM and command module around. With the massive service module gone, the craft suddenly responded crisply to his commands, and through the overhead window he saw the service module tumbling slowly as it departed. For the first time he could see what had happened to Apollo 13. "There's one whole side of that spacecraft missing. Look out there, would you?" Instead of the small puncture wound Lovell had imagined, the explosion had blown off an entire panel from the skin of the service module. Inside he could see tanks, pipes, and other equipment amid a tangle of torn mylar insulation. At the base of the cylindrical module, they could see that the big communications antenna had been bent out of position. The men fired off pictures until the service module was a speck in the distance. In Houston, flight controllers were chilled by the verbal picture of destruction. As to the cause of the accident, That would be for the review board to determine. But Ken Mattingly had a good idea of what they would find. He had been directly involved. Back in March, the launch teams at the Cape had conducted the countdown demonstration test, which included filling the spacecraft's tanks with cryogens and then emptying them again. When it came time to drain the service module's oxygen tanks, technicians were unable to remove the supercold fluid from tank number 2. For 11 days, they studied the problem. Mattingly went to briefings by the engineers, who had worked around the clock to find out what was wrong. They explained that the tank had originally been scheduled for Apollo 10, but had been removed for modifications and replaced. Sometime after that, the tank had been accidentally dropped a distance of 2 inches, a minor jolt, but enough to damage the tube assembly used to fill and empty the tank. That problem, never completely fixed, was the reason for the present difficulties. But there was an alternate procedure, they said, that would work around the problem. They would turn on the tank's built-in heaters and warm the liquid oxygen until it boiled off through the tank's relief valve. They asked Mattingly whether that sounded okay. He agreed, but neither Mattingly nor anyone else knew that the heater inside the tank had a design flaw. Back in 1965, the entire Apollo spacecraft, which was intended to operate at 28 volts of electricity, was upgraded to accept 65 volts from ground test equipment. Everything, that is, except the thermostat inside the service module's oxygen tanks. It was still rated for only 28 volts. No one caught the error. It was that thermostat that was supposed to shut off the heaters when the temperature inside the tank reached 80 degrees Fahrenheit. During the draining operation, the thermostat was activated, but the excess voltage caused an arc that welded its electrical contacts shut. The heaters stayed on for 8 solid hours, long enough for the temperature to reach 1,000 degrees. The technician monitoring the test was unaware of the dangerous condition because his temperature gauge went no higher than 85 degrees. Inside tank number 2, the intense heat baked and cracked Teflon insulation covering wires on a nearby motor. The motor controlled the fan inside the tank. Nothing more happened until 2 days, 7 hours, and 54 minutes into the flight of Apollo 13, when Jack Swigert turned on the fan at Mission Control's request. At that point, the review board would later decide, there was an electrical arc inside tank number 2. In moments, a fire had started inside the tank, fed by the generous supply of oxygen. Seconds later, the sudden surge of pressure blew off the tank's dome, flooding the surroundings with oxygen. When the pressure reached 30 pounds per square inch, the panel blew away in a jolt that probably also severed the plumbing for tank number 1, crippling Apollo 13. In the test flight business, big mistakes are often the result of many little ones. Mattingly would always carry with him the knowledge that he had signed off on Apollo 13's damaged oxygen tank, but he was by no means the only one who had failed to stop the process that led to the accident. A number of managers and engineers had also said, "Go ahead." So had Jim Lovell. 9 o'clock a.m. A strange and unprecedented combination, lunar module and command module, sped earthward. Inside Odyssey's dark, frigid cabin, Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes faced the moment of truth. With just 2.5 hours to go before re-entry, it was finally time to bring the command module fully back to life. They knew the systems must be even colder than it felt inside the cabin. No one knew if the navigation system would function again after such a prolonged cold soak. The design specification said it wouldn't work. They hoped the specs were wrong. Before they could do anything, they had to wipe off the gauges, because there was water all over the instrument panel. They knew there must be water behind the panel, too, clinging to the insulation around electrical connections, perhaps ready to short-circuit as soon as they began pushing in circuit breakers. Swigert and Hayes had no choice but to charge ahead, hoping they didn't see sparks or smell smoke. With relief, they realized their fears were unfounded. Undoubtedly, the modifications made to both the command module and the LM after the fire had prevented this potential disaster. and every one of Odyssey's systems revived in perfect condition, even the computer. Swigert was so glad to have his command module back that he didn't even need dexedrine. But for Hayes's friend, Lunar Module Number 7, time had nearly run out. Swigert and Hayes were in their couches in Odyssey, while Lovell, now crowded in Aquarius among bags of unneeded gear, steered the joined craft into position. When Lovell was back in the command module, the men sealed the hatches between the two craft. When Swigert hit the switch, there was a loud bang and a jolt far more violent than the oxygen tank explosion had been. Odyssey pitched perilously close to gimbal lock, but Swigert quickly steadied the ship. Then Hayes watched the departing LM. Legs extended, poised for landing on alien soil, but instead headed for a re-entry it would not survive. He wished there had been some way to bring it home and put it in a museum. Joe Kerwin spoke for all of them. Farewell, Aquarius, and we thank you. 11:43 a.m. Odyssey sped through darkness toward its rendezvous with Earth. Inside, Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes were strapped in their couches, exchanging last-minute bits of information with Houston. After 3 days of constant background noise from Aquarius's fans and pumps, the command module seemed unnaturally quiet. But now, with everything working perfectly, there was still a troubling unknown in Fred Hayes's mind, the condition of the heat shield. Even before they saw the service module, they had talked among themselves about the possibility that it had been cracked by the explosion. Of course, that resin-filled honeycomb structure was extremely tough, and a small crack would probably seal itself as the heat shield began to ablate in the heat of re-entry. A serious crack was another matter. But soon Hayes was far too busy to think about it. Now, with just 7 minutes to go until re-entry, Joe Kerwin radioed the welcome news that Odyssey's guidance system was perfect. Swigert suspected that when it was all over, the trajectory experts in mission control would have a great party, and he told Houston he wished he could go to it. Kerwin relayed an answer from someone in the control room. "We'll cover for you guys, and if Jack's got any phone numbers he wants us to call, pass them down." With 3 minutes to go, Lovell and his crew saw a tiny and distant moon, and as they watched, it blinked out, sinking behind the dark horizon exactly when mission control had predicted. And then the blackness of space gave way to the first soft light of ionized gas, a glow known only to the returning space traveler. Timber Cove, Texas. A crowd had gathered with Marilyn Lovell to watch the recovery on television. In the past 3.5 days, she had hardly left her house. Yesterday she had lunched with Fred Hayes's wife, Mary, who was very pregnant, at Deke Slayton's house, and earlier this morning she had gone to get Jim's mother from the nursing home so that she could watch too. For the past 2 days, her spirits rose steadily as the reports on Apollo 13 improved. Still, there had been difficult moments. She knew Jim wasn't getting much rest. At one point, someone sent word that Dr. Berry thought it might be a good idea if she went down to Mission Control and talked to Jim directly to convince him to go to sleep. She passed word back that she just couldn't do that. She knew that if she tried to talk to him, she would fall apart. Then, earlier this morning, she had been sitting by the squawk box when she heard Jim say, "There's one whole side of that spacecraft missing," and she panicked. With no NASA people around to ask, she called Pete Conrad, who said, I'll check on it, and soon she was reassured. But she would not rest easy until she saw the command module coming down on its parachutes. Now Marilyn sat in front of the TV among her close friends, with little Jeffrey at her side. Just minutes ago she had heard the last conversations between Jack Swigert and Mission Control. "Everybody says you're looking great," Kerwin had said. "Welcome home." "Thank you," Swigert had said, and then there was silence from Apollo 13. Long minutes passed as she waited anxiously for the communications blackout to end. She heard the NASA public affairs commentator say, "About 30 seconds to go for blackout, less than 10 seconds. We will attempt to contact Apollo 13 through one of the Apollo range instrumentation aircraft." and there was silence. Half a minute went by. Nothing. Now it was a full minute. Suddenly, we've had a report that the RAF-4 aircraft has acquisition of signal. Now she heard Joe Kerwin's voice. Odyssey, Houston, standing by. Long seconds passed. Finally, there was Jack Swigert. Okay, Joe. And still she could not relax. There were the parachutes yet to come. She was not alone in her tension. No one, either in mission control or inside the command module, knew whether the electronics to deploy the chutes were still good. On television, the broadcast from the recovery ship showed morning in the South Pacific, a calm sea under a patchwork of fair-weather clouds. She heard Kerwin radio to Apollo 13 that the weather was good. The public affairs officer counted down for the deployment of the drogue parachutes. Less than 2 minutes. Now 1 minute. Now 30 seconds. For interminable seconds it was hard to tell what was happening. Then the TV camera found the command module, a small dark cone floating out of the clouds on 3 beautiful orange parachutes. The room erupted in cheers, and Marilyn hugged Jeffrey so tightly that he cried out. Meanwhile, at the Space Center, cheers and applause thundered through mission control. Everyone shook hands and lit up cigars, including Ken Mattingly, who smiled and shook hands with Chuck Berry. And inside Odyssey, Jim Lovell remembered his ton of bricks splashdown from Apollo 8 and said to his crew, "Gentlemen, be prepared for a hard landing." But Odyssey must have caught the crest of a descending wave, for it fell gently onto a calm Pacific Ocean. As they waited for the swimmers to arrive, Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes lay on their couches, amazed that, even now, after the heat of re-entry, Odyssey was still so cold that they could see their breath. When the swimmers opened the hatch, a great cloud of frosty air issued into the tropical morning. The chill of space would linger inside Odyssey long after Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes were safely aboard the aircraft carrier Iwo Jima, recounting their ordeal for the doctors and savoring the fresh, warm air of Earth. Marilyn Lovell had never seen a party like the one that enveloped her house at splashdown. Nor had she seen so many champagne bottles emptied. People were leaning against the wall, unable to move. Marilyn lost her voice, but not before she went out to greet the reporters who had kept a patient vigil throughout the past 4 days. She jokingly gave them the old standby, happy, thrilled, and proud, and one of them asked her what the past 4 days had been like. "It's been a nightmare," she told them. "I have never experienced anything like this in my life, and I never hope to experience it again." That wasn't the kind of talk usually acceptable for an astronaut wife, but now, for the first time since Jim became a test pilot, she had no reason to hide anything. The day after Lovell's crew splashed down, Richard Nixon came to the Space Center and presented the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Gene Kranz, Glenn Lunny, and the other flight directors of Apollo 13. Tom Paine was there too, sitting on the stage, watching as Nixon praised the ingenuity and courage of the NASA and industry personnel who had saved the lives of the 3 astronauts. For many in the audience, Apollo 13 would always be NASA's finest hour. But the irony was that even now, Paine's vision for the space program was crumbling. In March, the White House had issued a statement saying that space would no longer hold such a high position in the list of national priorities. There would be no expensive new programs, especially not in the area of manned spaceflight. There would be no money spent on any effort linked to the goal of sending humans to Mars. By summer, NASA's goal of a space station and reusable space shuttle was coming under fire in the Senate, where Walter Mondale protested, "I believe it would be unconscionable to embark on a project of such staggering cost when many of our citizens are malnourished, when our rivers and lakes are polluted, and when our cities and rural areas are dying." He asked, "What are our values? What do we think is more important?" Despite this and other outcries, Congress approved the NASA budget by a slim margin at the end of July. The next day, Tom Paine surprised his colleagues at NASA by resigning as administrator to take a management job in industry. He would leave to his successor the coming battles for support, not from Congress, but from Richard Nixon. But it was already clear that Nixon had rejected the vision proposed by the Space Task Group. By September, only the space shuttle had any chance of being approved, and that was still uncertain at best. As presidential adviser John Ehrlichman told historian John Logsdon years later, inflation and other priorities were more important. The budget just wasn't big enough to do everything NASA wanted. Furthermore, Nixon was unwilling to pay for a Mars effort that would not bear political fruit until after he left office. But Apollo was another matter. After Apollo 13, some of Nixon's advisers, wary that a space disaster would do him political harm, had urged him to cancel the rest of the moon missions, but he resisted. According to Ehrlichman, the moon program held magic for Nixon for one reason. He liked heroes. To him, the astronauts represented the best the country could produce. It was good for the nation, Nixon believed, to have heroes.
Chapter 8. The Story of a Full-Up Mission, Apollo 14. 1. Big Al Flies Again. Some memories are so bright that the passage of time cannot dim them. For Alan Bartlett Shepard, the brightest was May 5, 1961. On that Friday morning, while a nation watched and listened, he lay inside a tiny spacecraft called Freedom 7, atop a redstone booster and waited to be hurled into space. The space program had suffered more than its share of failures, and images of exploding rockets were burned into the national psyche. The suspense was almost unbearable. This launch would give a badly needed boost to national morale and prestige, if Shepard wasn't killed. As for Shepard himself, he had a different worry. He didn't want to screw up. Inside Freedom 7, Shepard fought nervousness by concentrating on his work. For hours, the count was held up by one problem after another. First the weather, then technical difficulties, and Shepard's mood turned impatient. With less than 3 minutes to go, minor trouble with the redstone halted the count yet again. Over the radio, Shepard could hear the engineers in the blockhouse anxiously debating whether to postpone the launch, and what he said was the stuff of folklore. "I'm cooler than you are. Why don't you fix your little problem and light this candle?" At 9:30 a.m., fire erupted from the redstone, and Shepard rose from the east coast of Florida and soared into a sunlit infinity. 15 minutes later, having arced like a guided cannonball to an altitude of 115 miles, Freedom 7 splashed down in the Atlantic, and a nation rejoiced. Within days, Shepard stood in the White House Rose Garden to receive NASA's Distinguished Service Medal from John F. Kennedy. Afterward, he rode in an open car down Pennsylvania Avenue to the adulation of thousands. Sitting next to him, Vice President Lyndon Johnson was amazed. "Where did all these people come from? You're a famous man, Shepard." Yes, he was a national hero. But the most precious thing Shepard gained that day wasn't glory. The true pilot, he would say years later, never does it for the fame, but the satisfaction of having been first. Fierce competition for the first Mercury flight, and with it the chance to become the first man in space, had been an undercurrent in everything the original Seven did. But the choice was up to their boss, Bob Gilruth, the soft-spoken head of the Space Task Group, who thought of the astronauts as his boys. One day Gilruth asked each of the Seven to conduct a peer vote. "If you yourself cannot be the one to make the first flight," he said, "who do you think it should be?" Shepard wondered if this was some kind of stunt, dreamed up by the shrinks who had been part of the Seven's lives since the astronaut selection. There was actually a duty psychologist, Bob Voas, assigned to them. Shepard never did trust him. Shepard had no idea whether the peer vote was important, but he didn't worry about it. There were no bad pilots among the Seven, Shepard knew. Although NASA had overlooked some discrepancies in their piloting backgrounds in its zeal to select perfect mental and physical specimens, but he had no doubts about where he stood, and never had. That supreme self-confidence was with him when he graduated from the Naval Academy in 1944, ready to end the conflict in the Pacific, single-handed. After the war, he began his aviation career, flying off carriers and moving on to become a test pilot at Pax River. It was that quiet arrogance that Shepard, more than any of his colleagues, brought to the business of being an astronaut. Still, Shepard doubted he would be chosen. He figured the first flight would go to his main rival, John Glenn. Among the seven, it was Glenn, charismatic and devout. With the Ohio small-town background and the sunny, freckle-faced look of an all-American, who most embodied the hero the country was looking for in its astronauts. At the original Seven's first press conference, which had scared some of them half to death, Glenn had been a natural. For an image-conscious NASA, Shepard figured, Glenn was the obvious choice. And Glenn, with his own resume of test flight accomplishments, was as determined as any of them to be first. Around mid-January 1961, Gil Ruth came to see the Seven in their office and announced that after much consideration, the pilot for the first flight would be Alan Shepard. Grissom would get the second flight. Glenn would back up both flights. As Gil Ruth spoke, Shepard was looking at the floor, and long seconds passed before he looked up to see the other six coming over to congratulate him. It wasn't hard to guess that their smiles concealed great disappointment, but Shepard couldn't have known that John Glenn was so angry that he later considered going to Jim Webb to try to get the decision changed, then thought better of it. NASA kept the selection a secret, saying only that one of the three, Glenn, Grissom, or Shepard, would make the flight. Then came the tough part. Looking back, the months leading up to the flight had been a true test, especially putting up with the forecasters of doom. They warned that a man would not survive a space mission, that he would succumb to the G-forces of launch and re-entry, that weightlessness would wreak havoc on his vision, or his sense of orientation, or his bodily functions. Some psychologists were predicting that the astronaut would experience a profound sense of separation from Earth, a break-off phenomenon, and be rendered helpless. Nor were these pronouncements coming from the fringe. In April, representatives of the President's Scientific Advisory Committee went down to the NASA offices in Langley, Virginia, and voiced their trepidation about the flight. Shepard, Glenn, and Grissom all volunteered to take extra runs on the monstrous centrifuge at Johnsville, just to prove to the skeptics that their fears were unfounded. Meanwhile, within NASA, Mercury planners looked ahead confidently. A chimpanzee named Ham had already made the trip and had come back in good shape. However, because of some minor problems with the booster, NASA postponed Shepard's March launch until early May to allow time for one more unmanned test. Then, early in the morning of April 12th, Shepard's hopes of being the first man in space evaporated as the world learned that a 27-year-old Russian pilot named Yuri Gagarin had orbited the Earth. Shepard fumed that NASA hadn't seized the chance to send him up in March, but there was nothing to do about it now. Shepard and everyone else connected with Project Mercury were caught up in preparations for the launch. After the May 2nd attempt was scrubbed because of the weather, NASA could no longer conceal the pilot's identity. By the time he climbed atop the Redstone on May 5th, the eyes of the nation were on him. So were John Kennedy's. When Shepard flew, the president was already weighing the decision of whether to attempt a moon program. Shepard's flight put him over the edge. Shepard would always believe that the immense outpouring of pride that greeted his flight made a great impression on Kennedy. If a suborbital hop from Florida to Bermuda could so energize the nation, imagine what would happen if America put a man on the moon. By May 25th, less than 3 weeks after Shepard's triumphant ride down Pennsylvania Avenue, Kennedy had made his decision. That day, as he addressed a joint session of Congress, his closest aides could tell he was nervous. By the way, he kept playing with the pages of his speech, creasing them, smoothing them. They sensed that Kennedy wasn't sure he was doing the right thing to ask for such an enormous sum of money for something so audacious. But none of that showed in his voice as he spoke the words that would mark the genesis of Apollo. When Shepard next saw Kennedy, it was in February 1962, after John Glenn's orbital mission, which drew so much public celebration that it overshadowed the reaction to his own flight. Aboard Air Force One, Flying from West Palm Beach to Washington, Glenn, Shepard, and Grissom sat with Kennedy undisturbed for most of the 90-minute flight. They talked about Glenn's experiences and about the moon program. Aides came in and out of the forward cabin, but Kennedy wasn't interested in them. He didn't want to talk about anything but space. That day, Shepard saw the man's pioneer spirit. Some said the moon decision had been motivated by political concerns, but to Shepard it had been an act of statesmanship, not politics. And it was clear to him, inside Air Force One, that the lure of space exploration was very real to John Kennedy. The following September, when Kennedy delivered his stirring speech at Rice University Stadium, Shepard saw a president who was behind Apollo all the way. By that time, Shepard was already thinking about getting into space again. His own flight had been so brief, 15 minutes and 28 seconds, and so busy, 2 minutes for this test, a minute for that one, that it had merely whetted his appetite. For raw thrills, nothing could top it, but it hadn't been long enough for him to really show what he could do. He wanted the next flight he could get, though he would have to wait his turn on the rotation. That came after Gordon Cooper circled the Earth for 34 hours in May 1963. Shepard made a bid for a 3-day mission, but Jim Webb, anxious to get on with Gemini, was very much against prolonging Mercury with the time, energy, and expense that would entail. With Webb's knowledge, Shepard took his case to Kennedy himself, but in the end, Webb prevailed. Shepard's disappointment was short-lived. He was still at the top of the rotation. Gemini was coming, and after that he could look forward to Apollo. Soon Shepard was assigned as the commander of the first Gemini mission, with Tom Stafford as his co-pilot. But that summer Shepard's fortunes changed abruptly. At home one day, he was suddenly swept with dizziness, nausea, and vomiting. When he recovered, he thought he was coming down with the flu, but within days he had a second attack, and then a third. Reluctantly, he took his problem to the NASA doctors. Their diagnosis was Meniere's syndrome, an inner ear disorder characterized by a buildup of excess fluid in the semicircular canals, causing impaired balance and attacks of vertigo. Medications would control the vertigo, the doctors said, but the prognosis was bad. There was no cure for Meniere's syndrome, and unless Shepard was among the 25% for whom the disease clears up on its own, he would never make another space flight. At first, Shepard was optimistic. He told Stafford, "We're going to fight this thing." But soon the pair were taken off the flight. Stafford was eventually reassigned to a Gemini mission, but Shepard had no recourse. He was forbidden even to fly an airplane by himself. For an astronaut, it was like a death sentence. For 6 years, Shepard lived with the stigma of being grounded. He never gave any thought to leaving the astronaut corps. He still hoped the disease might go away spontaneously. In the meantime, Deke Slayton had his hands full trying to run the newly created Flight Crew Operations Directorate, and he asked Shepard to take over the astronaut office. Through Gemini and into Apollo, Shepard handled the humdrum administrative affairs, coordinating training and travel schedules, approving interview requests and the like. Knowing the collection of egos under him, the prima donnas who balked at serving on a backup crew, Shepard felt compelled to use a firm hand. It meant he had few friends in the office, but that never seemed to bother him. In fact, it was better for morale not to give even the appearance of favoritism. A chief astronaut who could not fly was like a warrior king who could not fight, and Shepard's frustration was magnified by his role in preparing other astronauts for their missions. It began with the secret crew selection process, of which Shepard was always a key part. Then, as each crew trained, he followed their progress at the Cape. On launch morning, he ate breakfast with them, and then he did the hardest thing of all. He walked them out the door of the crew quarters and watched as they climbed into the transfer van and rode away, heading for the launch pad. But the care and feeding of astronauts did little to satisfy Shepard's appetite for a challenge. To fill the void, he turned to business. Even before he was an astronaut, Shepard had dabbled in real estate and made a respectable sum of money. The Mercury era had left him well connected to the Houston social and business scene, and he was getting some expert advice from Leo D'Orsi, the lawyer who guided the original Seven through the Life magazine contract and other unfamiliar waters. Shepard logged his share of failures, but also successes, especially with his lucrative part ownership of Houston's Baytown Bank. Within a few years, he had amassed a small empire that, at one time or another, included partnerships in shopping centers, hotels, and other assorted enterprises around the country. He bought a $200,000 house in Houston's opulent River Oaks district. If Shepard's escapades drew some private envy and resentment, both inside and outside the astronaut office, no one could fault him for the way he looked after the astronauts' interests within the Space Center. And while he was sometimes known to put in half days in the astronaut office and spend the rest on outside business, one of his Mercury colleagues would later say, "Al never let anybody down in that job." That was the beauty of Al Shepard. He could do both. On the fifth anniversary of Shepard's flight, the astronaut office threw a party for him, and they showed a movie called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Flying Very Much, a slight alteration of the title of a very popular Broadway play. By that time, at age 42, Shepard was on the way to becoming a millionaire. But none of this mattered to Shepard compared with making another space flight. By the spring of 1968, his astronaut career was slipping through his fingers. His condition had worsened. He still had attacks of vertigo, and he was nearly deaf in his left ear. But Tom Stafford had heard about a Los Angeles ear surgeon named William House, who had devised a delicate, risky operation to help Meniere's sufferers. The procedure involved implanting a small silicone tube in the ear to drain the excess fluid from the semicircular canals through the mastoid bone to the top of the spinal column. Shepard went to see House, who warned that it would take some time to know whether the operation would be a success. He gave no guarantees. In the summer of 1968, Shepard secretly checked into a Los Angeles hospital as Victor Poulos, a name chosen by the admissions nurse, who was Greek. Shepard had ruled out the surgery until he had nothing left to lose. That time had come. In the summer of 1968, Stuart Roosa didn't have the luxury of worrying whether he would ever make a second space flight. He was still waiting for his first, and things didn't look good. Like his colleagues in the original 19, he'd been immersed in rookie's labors for the better part of 2 years. A thin, red-headed Oklahoma native, Roosa was 35, but he seemed not to have aged a day since he was a smoke jumper for the U.S. Forest Service in Oregon 15 years earlier. On their first date, he had told his future wife, Joan, that he was going to be an engineering test pilot. But if there had been no Edwards and no NASA, Stu Roosa would probably have gone to Vietnam, for he had spent much of his adult life preparing to fly in combat. As a newly minted Air Force fighter pilot, he'd spent a year in gunnery training. Then, in 1955, he was assigned to the 510 Fighter Bomber Squadron in Langley, Virginia. The 510's official designation was Special Weapons. In plain English, that meant nuclear bombs. The 510 trained for the unthinkable, a full-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The plan, which remained secret for years, called for the pilots to deploy out of bases in West Germany. Flying their F-100s over Russia, they would drop down to 50 or 100 feet to avoid the enemy's radar. At carefully chosen points, each man would arm his weapon and execute a series of precise maneuvers, pull back on the stick, watch the airspeed like a hawk, and at exactly the right moment, with the jet zooming almost straight up, release the bomb, which would then follow a 2-mile-long ballistic arc to the target. Meanwhile, the pilots would head in the other direction as fast as their jets could take them to be safely out of range of the ensuing destruction. The planes did not carry enough fuel to reach their targets inside Russia and make it back. The pilots planned to eject hundreds of miles from the base and then, making use of special training in escape and evasion, walk the rest of the way. Decades after the fact, it may be difficult to understand why Stu Roosa, like the other men in the 510, was not only prepared to carry out this mission, but half wished he would get a chance to. But in 1955, at the height of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear war was a grim fact of life. Communism was the enemy, and Roosa's desire to defend his country from it was exceeded only by his love of flying. He would never forget the first time he was cleared to take off on his own as an Air Force cadet. In the open canopy, with the sun on his face and the roar of the engine filling his senses, he began to sing the Air Force song, "Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder." If that sounded like Life magazine's image of an astronaut, then in fact Roussa was it, more than many of his colleagues. He was a straight-laced, conservative family man with a soldier's devotion to his country, and when he became a member of the original 19 in 1966, he was ready to dedicate his energies to the peaceful war that was Project Apollo. No sooner had he arrived at NASA than he attended the party the astronauts threw for the 5th anniversary of Al Shepard's Mercury flight. He looked around and felt awed, in spite of himself. He turned to his wife, Joan, and said, "Do you know that the first person on the moon is in this room tonight?" Roussa had no illusions that that person might be himself or any of the original 19. He was just one more in a sea of faces at the Monday morning pilots' meetings. He and his friend Charlie Duke were assigned to cover the Saturn boosters. To them it felt like a backwater, but as the time for the first Apollo missions neared, the astronauts began to show more interest in Roussa's work. And then, one day in the fall of 1968, he was at North American when Al Shepard called him to say, "We want you to be on the support crew for Apollo 9. Then he added, "Just be patient, I've got something in the works." Shepard's tone was so matter-of-fact that the comment barely registered. Roussa was just glad that he was finally moving out of the pack. Roussa's assignment was to help coordinate the activities in mission control, and he logged months of simulations with the flight controllers. When Apollo 9 flew, Roussa was more involved than anyone expected. After Rusty Schweikert suffered motion sickness, Roussa was part of the scramble to reorganize the schedule and save as many of the mission objectives as possible. He knew more about the flight plan than any astronaut who was still on Earth, and he was at the Capcom's mic almost every minute that McDivitt's crew was awake. When the other controllers left at the end of their 8-hour shifts, Roussa just stayed where he was. After it was all over, Deke Slayton told him, "You were more on top of it than the flight directors were." Just as importantly, Chris Kraft took notice, and Roussa had always felt Kraft had a great deal of influence on an astronaut's career. But Roussa still had no sense of where he stood, and he didn't know what to make of it when one day Deke asked him, "Has Al talked to you about your new assignment?" Al Shepard had always been a mysterious, intimidating figure to Roussa. Going to Al Shepard's office was as nerve-wracking as going to see the general. Roussa always made sure his thoughts were organized and his hair was combed. But around the fall of 1968, Roussa had begun to notice some subtle changes in Big Al. At the pilots' meetings, Shepard showed an unusual interest in the tech talk, not just whether a man was on top of his work, but the details of what he was saying. Some new change in the spacecraft or a mission plan. For the first time since anybody could remember, he started showing up at the gym. Every now and then, Roussa would see him in mission control, talking to flight controllers. Roussa had no idea what was going on, until one day in April, when he was summoned to Shepard's office, along with Ed Mitchell. When they got there, Shepard was grinning broadly. "If you guys don't mind flying with an old retread, we're the prime crew of Apollo 13. Roussa couldn't believe what he was hearing. No rookie had ever gone straight onto an Apollo prime crew without serving as a backup. He said to Shepard, "Did you say prime?" Shepard flashed him a steely glance. "I said prime." The surgery had worked. By the spring of 1969, the doctors had pronounced Shepard whole. He was back on flight status and ready to take any mission he could get. He would have been happy to fly in Earth orbit on Apollo applications if that's where Deke wanted him. At a small press conference, a reporter asked Shepard who would take his place helping Slayton with the crew assignments, and Shepard said he guessed Deke would have to do it all by himself, and then, barely containing a laugh, he added, "Of course, my old buddy Deke, good old Deke," and the place broke up. Someone asked, "Will you campaign?" Shepard replied, "You're not supposed to." But then he didn't have to. His last act as Slayton's co-author on crew selections was something no other astronaut could have pulled off. He recommended himself for the very next flight available. In the spring of 1969, that was Apollo 13. Slayton obliged him. Word got around the astronaut office that Alan Shepard was now the commander of Apollo 13, and the reactions were mixed. Behind closed doors, more than one of the pilots expressed resentment that Shepard could walk right onto a prime crew without doing his turn as a backup. In reality, Shepard's ego ruled that out, nor was there any danger he might have to accept middle or right seat. Others realized that it was pointless to say that Al Shepard was cutting in line. He had been in line from the day he arrived, and as far as Deke Slayton was concerned, if Shepard wasn't qualified, no one was. Only one other member of the original seven was still on flight status. For him, the news of Shepard's assignment was grim. For years now, Gordo Cooper's star had steadily fallen. No one would argue that he had flown a spectacular Mercury mission, by some accounts the best of the series, but after that he had begun to slack off. He had always raised casual to new heights. It was Cooper who, perched atop a fully fueled Atlas booster, waiting out a hold in the count, fell asleep. His strap-it-on-and-go attitude was legendary, but unfortunately he seemed to carry it into training. On his Gemini 5 flight, the other astronauts had to goad him into the simulator. No one who witnessed that episode was surprised when his next assignment was a dead-end stint on the backup crew of Gemini 12. When Slayton gave him another backup post for Apollo 10, some wondered whether Cooper would ever fly again. Cooper didn't help himself by entering a 24-hour road race at Daytona while he was in training. Slayton was no happier about that than a movie studio would be about a major star doing his own stunts. Too much was invested in him to subject him to unnecessary risk. When Slayton pulled him from the race, Cooper bitched to the press, "They ought to hire tiddlywinks players as astronauts." In any case, Slayton had named him to back up Apollo 10 with the idea that he'd probably be able to fill in for Tom Stafford if necessary, but he was not at all sure that he'd follow the rotation and give Cooper command of Apollo 13. When Shepard became available, a few weeks before Apollo 10 flew, Slayton's choice was easy. Cooper would later hold an angry press conference, saying that Shepard had unfairly edged him out of his mission, but the truth was that Cooper had let the moon slip beyond his reach, and so Alan Shepard would become the only one of the original seven to reach the moon. But not on Apollo 13. For the first time since he had begun selecting crews, Slayton's assignment was vetoed by George Mueller, head of manned spaceflight at NASA headquarters. Mueller insisted that after so long on the bench, Shepard needed more time to train. Slayton argued that Shepard had been in training for 13 since the spring and was making good progress. Shepard himself knew he had some catching up to do, but he'd had a head start. Even while he'd been grounded, he had been learning the basics of the command module and the LM, and like every rookie astronaut, he'd been grabbing simulator time whenever he could get it. He felt confident he'd be ready in time for Apollo 13. But Mueller held firm. Slayton had no choice but to swap Shepard's disappointed crew with Jim Lovells, who had just finished backing up Apollo 11. One day in August, Slayton took Lovell aside and asked him whether he and his team could be ready for 13. And Jim Lovell, happily surprised at the offer, said yes. For Alan Shepard, the events of April 1970 had special irony. In the years after the fire, it had occurred to him that being grounded might have saved his life. He might well have been the commander of Apollo 1 instead of Gus Grissom. Now he had been saved from the ordeal of Apollo 13 by George Mueller. Shepard wasn't alone in such thoughts. Stu Roosa had been in mission control when Apollo 13 became a struggle to save the lives of three men. Initially, he had been one of those who thought there was no hope for Lovell's crew, but over the next 4 days he'd witnessed the most impressive recovery in NASA's history. In Houston, as the accident investigators issued their report and engineers went to work on safeguards for later missions, the flight controllers savored a new confidence. Whatever problems might come up, they knew they would handle them. They were eager to take on Apollo 14, which had been postponed from July of 1970 until the end of the year. But in the wake of their masterful rescue, which NASA called a successful failure, Apollo once again faded in the national consciousness. Even during the ordeal of Apollo 13, amid global concern, the country's attention had been divided. While NASA struggled to save Lovell's crew, a professor at Duke University encountered one of his students and asked, "Do you think they'll get them back?" The student responded by talking about the American troops in Vietnam. At the beginning of May, the U.S. invasion of Cambodia intensified the campus unrest over the war. Days later, during a demonstration at Kent State University, four students were killed by young, nervous National Guardsmen. By summer, the nation's conflict over the war in Vietnam had deepened. It was also a troubled time for NASA. The relative austerity in the space budget continued to affect the program. At the Cape, there were bumper stickers that read, "Apollo 14, One Giant Leap for Unemployment." At the end of August, faced with additional cuts, acting NASA Administrator George Lowe, who had taken over after Payne's departure, canceled two more Apollo missions. In the astronaut office, morale skidded as many saw their chances to go to the moon slip away. And the astronaut image was showing signs of wear. It had been a year since Don Isley left his wife for another woman. For years, astronauts had kept shaky marriages together because no one knew how the alternative would affect a spaceflight career. If the Isleys' split stunned the astronaut office, it tore apart the community of wives, many of whom were forced to admit, at least privately, what they had carefully ignored for so many years. Their husbands were playing around. The Astronaut Wives Club, which had been the nucleus for social gatherings, was so shaken over whether to invite Isley's new wife that it ultimately dissolved. Isley left NASA without flying again, and some wondered whether his divorce had been the reason. But at the end of 1969, Al Worden, assigned to Apollo 15, showed that an astronaut could end his marriage and remain on a space crew. For the most part, Stu Roosa had little time to think about these events, or anything else besides Apollo 14. It was true that he had pilot friends in Vietnam, and as always, he felt a little guilty about not flying alongside them. When one of them came home and expressed anger over the way the war was being handled and bitterness at the dissent at home, Roosa shared his distress, but he was more upset over what was happening to Apollo. He could not believe the nation was abandoning the most magnificent exploration in its history. The impact on Roosa was very real. He had known that as command module pilot of Apollo 14, assuming he stayed in the rotation, he would eventually command Apollo 20, but his hopes of landing on the moon had died in January 1970 when Apollo 20 was canceled. But Roosa's personal concerns paled beside the demands of his mission. In addition to the normal training workload, he had to look after the modifications to the command and service modules. And Shepard had done something that impressed Roosa greatly. He'd let Roosa handle it. He didn't micromanage. He wasn't afraid to delegate. He had faith in his crew, and Roosa had every faith in Shepard. The man was very sharp, a quick study, and in Roosa's opinion, the most competent astronaut in the office. He was also probably the most complicated man Roosa had ever known, but one thing was certain, this wasn't the same Big Al who had lorded over the astronaut office. When he came on flight status, he stepped down gracefully to the trench work of a mission commander. He was genuinely pleasant to work for. Roosa introduced him to his parents, and they were charmed by him. Once Shepard accepted a person into his inner circle, he could be surprisingly open. Of course, he could still turn to ice without warning, which is to say, he was still Al Shepard, but he never directed that anger at his crew. And when it came time to make up a mission patch, Shepard sketched a design that showed an astronaut pin flying from the Earth to the moon to convey that the entire astronaut office was going along, in spirit. In his own way, Shepard was the best commander Roosa could have asked for. He nicknamed him Fearless Leader. Ed Mitchell, the man who would land on the moon with Shepard, had a doctorate from MIT and test pilot credentials from the space school at Edwards. In the astronaut office, it was his intellectual bent that set him apart from some of the other pilots, along with a certain hard edge. By his own admission, he had an impatient streak, and when angered, he was capable of outbursts of temper. But when Mitchell spoke, it was with the soft voice of a midnight FM radio announcer. Roosa shared an office with him and used to wonder how anybody at the other end of a phone conversation with him could understand what he was saying. But Roosa respected him as a professional. What really mattered was that Mitchell do his job in the command module, and that he did very well. And from what Roosa could tell, Mitchell, who matched Fred Hayes in his knowledge of the LM, seemed to be carrying the load for Shepard with the lander systems, letting his commander concentrate on the piloting. Shepard, Roosa, and Mitchell trained for 19 months, longer than any crew before them, but even now Rusa did not really think of them as friends. Al Shepard wasn't Pete Conrad, and you wouldn't see the crew of Apollo 14 going out for a beer together at the end of the day. And Rusa couldn't have cared less. What really mattered, and what they shared with every crew before them, was a burning desire for what Rusa called a full-up mission, that is, every objective on the flight plan accomplished. By January 1971, NASA was ready to send Shepard's crew to the moon to complete the mission Lovell's team had been denied. Apollo 14 would be the first flight devoted solely to the scientific exploration of the moon. Using the pinpoint landing technique proven on Apollo 12, Shepard and Mitchell would make the first landing in the lunar uplands at a place called Fra Mauro. While they made two moonwalks, including a climb to the rim of the 1,100-foot diameter cone crater, Rusa would survey the moon from orbit with a special high-resolution camera called the HiCon. Rusa sensed that this time a full-up mission had special importance. NASA couldn't afford another failure. In 1961, Shepard had been the man of the hour. As far as Rusa was concerned, there wasn't anyone better to entrust with the future of the space program than Alan Shepard. There were some people who wondered why, at age 47, having acquired fame, wealth, and status as an American hero, Alan Shepard would risk his life to go to the moon. The passage of 10 years had deepened the lines around his mouth and his blue, slightly bugged eyes, but the toothy grin was the same as it had been on the cover of Life magazine in 1961, and though the military crew cut was gone, his hair now fell part way across his forehead, his reasons for wanting to fly in space had not changed. In Shepard's mind, to say that he was brave, to call him a hero, was hopelessly incomplete. He was a supreme test pilot, and nothing mattered more to him than getting a chance to prove it. A decade ago, lying atop that gleaming redstone rocket, he had watched as technicians sealed him inside Freedom 7 and had steeled himself. "Okay, Buster, you volunteered for this thing." On January 31, 1971, Shepard led his crew to Pad 39A, where a booster 100 times more powerful was waiting for them. There was more thrust in the command module's escape rocket than there had been in the Redstone. His spaceflight experience was surpassed the moment Apollo 14 reached Earth orbit. 2 hours and 20 minutes later, when the Saturn's third stage ignited, Shepard was heading for the goal he'd kept in sight for nearly a decade. Not the moon, but the chance to show what he was made of. Years later, Shepard would say that he always believed in pushing out the frontier. It was nice that the moon happened to get in the way. 2. To the Promised Land. Sunday, January 31st, 1971, 7:41 p.m. Houston time, 4 hours, 38 minutes mission elapsed time. Apollo 14 almost ended before it could begin. As launch time neared, Shepard's crew had looked ahead to their mission with an almost arrogant confidence. With the intensive scrutiny after Apollo 13, nothing should interfere with their mission. But now, only 2 hours after a perfect translunar injection burn, Shepard, Rusa, and Mitchell found themselves waiting for word from Houston, wondering whether they could continue. The trouble had begun shortly after Stu Rosa cut loose from the Saturn third stage and prepared to dock the command module Kitty Hawk with the lander Antares. In the past 19 months, he had simulated the maneuver so many times that he used less fuel than any command module pilot before him. Now he was doing it for real, and he wanted that fuel record. Floating above the center seat, Shepard peered through the hatch window as if he were hanging from a ledge by his fingers. He could see Antares dead ahead, and he told